Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and I'm delighted to say that my guest today is so well known that he barely needs an introduction. He has written over 150 books and won numerous awards. He served as a children's laureate and is known the world over for his children's books, War Horse in particular. He was knighted in 2018 for services to literature and charity, and it goes without saying that I'm honoured and delighted to have him with me today, Michael Moore-Purger. A very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Oh, well, thank you for coming along and sitting by the Thames, which is glorious.
Well, it is very beautiful. Now, I'm very glad to say that your new book, Funny Things Getting Older, has been extremely helpful in preparing for this conversation, as it's a collection of your various writing down the years and also contains transcripts of many of your points of view for BBC Radio 4. And it makes a fascinating read because it's really a summary of your life. And there's quite a bit about your childhood in it, which I think our listeners would be fascinated to hear about.
I was born in 43, and I was, you could say, collateral damage from the war. Apparently the divorce rate went up by 4 times just after the Second World War, and my family was a casualty of that. My father was away at the war. He was in Baghdad, I believe, when he got the news that my mother had found someone else to be with, a man called Jack Moore-Purger, who became my stepfather later. And so my brother Peter and myself and my mother were, we never knew our father at all. Growing up, he did come back from the war, but rather quickly after went off to Canada. He was an actor, and I think a lot of British actors were looking for work after the war. And he went out with Tyrone Guthrie to Canada and made his life there and married again there. And so we didn't see him for many, many, many years. We grew up in a step family. So that was the first thing. And that step family, with Jack and my mother and my brother and then two half-brothers, half-brother, half-sister, we moved away from our growing up place, really, which was in Philbeach Gardens in the west of London. I left there when I was about 7 or 8, something like that, that sort of age, and went to, I don't know why they chose it, but there was a lovely village called Bradwell on Sea, and it was beautiful. We lived in a great old house full of cobwebs, sort of Georgian and Tudor both at the same time. It was wonderful, many, many ways quite wonderful, and it did become a paradise for me because I wasn't an urban child anymore. I could go for walks or cycle rides, and that's the place I first saw hares. Yes, they do box, and I did see that. Mm-hmm. And I first really came in contact with the countryside and nature. So it was my introduction to all that side of my life, which has become so important since, was Bradwell. And then we had a very interesting, rather modern thing that happened, which was that people up in London, someone thought it was a really good idea to pick this place to construct an atomic power station.
No.
I believe it was the second atomic power station in this country. Anyway, there was a great row in the village, a huge row. It's the first time I ever saw people doing fisticuffs in a village street. And my family, I think rather naturally, didn't want it to happen. And now, all these years later, it is going to sit there wrapped in concrete for 200 years. And if you are standing there and you look out, you see the ancient Saxon chapel, and you just turn your neck just a little bit, and there's this great, you know, wart on the landscape. Anyway, my family moved. I think they were rather alarmed by the whole idea. And it was a poisonous place. I mean, it poisoned the only little industry which was going there, which I didn't know about at the time. But apparently oysters were very big in that part of the Essex coast. But anyway, we went off and lived somewhere else, moved back to London. But actually, I was then sent to boarding school. It was a good solution. So I went on to boarding school at the age of 7.
Gosh, where did you go?
Oh, a hideous place. And actually, what was really, it was a beautiful place in the sense it was overlooking Ashdown Forest in Sussex. And it was pretty oppressive in all sorts of, as schools were in the 1950s, I think.
Bagging, beating,
all that. Yes, stuff. Lots of very damaged people back from the war, no doubt, and with all sorts of troubles of their own, but they did take it out on the children rather. One woman in the place, the matron, who was perfectly nice, but the rest of it was an entirely male establishment. And quite difficult to put up with. You only put up with it, really, because everyone else was putting up with it, too. I did learn resilience there. So I got used to it, and I suppose I grew a sort of skin to put up with the whole thing. And luckily, I found something I was good at. What I could do is play rugby and play cricket. When I used to sing, I was in the choir, I'll tell you in a minute, of a very musical school the second time, in Canterbury, King's Canterbury. So I went off to this school, and having proved to myself that I could sing, I could play rugby, and that I was a bit stupid, and that was all right, because I was a good chap, you know, it was all right. So I went to this other school, which was not beastly at all, and I think it prided itself on being musty and dusty and damp and cold. I mean, we had a dormitory, I think it was 25 people, which was an old monastic room, and with these creaky beds.
Iron beds. Candlewick counterpane.
And it really was, when I say it now, people don't believe me. It was by the city wall, and the night watchman really did walk by the dormitory window. Yes, it was a wonderful thing. He used to come by. The last thing at time we heard him at night time, he'd literally walk by and he would say, 11 o'clock, a fine night, and all's well. So anyway, that was my school time after my horrible prep school. And it was, I loved the school. I've only just been back there. I did a thing the other night, which was rather fun. There was another fairly decent writer who went to the chat called Christopher Marlowe. You probably haven't interviewed him.
You have to be very old. It really is an old school, goodness. Yes.
It's very, very old. Christopher Marlowe, of course, didn't end terribly well, but he wrote a decent play or two. Anyway, there aren't that many people. Paddy Lee Fernwell went there, people like that. But there was. They asked me to be would I lend my name to the Literary Society there? So I said, well, that'd be lovely. And I went back to do a talk, and I was invited back, and they had arranged for 400 or so sixth formers. This is the beginning of October. It's only just happened. And they said, we think this is rather strange. You may not want to do it, but what we really want to do is to do storytelling by a campfire. And there they were, 400 now girls and boys, sitting on the ground, wrapped up in blankets, with braziers all around to keep us warm. And then they listened to a story. My wife Claire was there. And we were sitting on thrones on the stage, got big sort of armchairs. It got damper and damper as the evening went on. But it was fun. So I'm sort of still in touch with the place. I owe it a lot. I mean, it gave me a lot of inspiration, all my love for music and that side of me. And making me, I think what those schools can do really well is to make you feel when you leave that you could do anything. You know, that can turn into arrogance with no problem at all. But in my case, I went into the army, and your arrogance, if I had any, and I'm sure I did, was wiped out rather quickly by a sergeant major on a parade ground at Sandhurst.
Why the army, and how long did that last?
Why? I suppose when I was brought up, it was just post-war. So the heroes around the place when I was growing up, well, yes, they were football stars on cigarette guards. But they were also the people who'd been to the war. Now, in my family, I had two uncles. One was my uncle Peter, who was killed in the RAF when he was 21. He was an actor. Interestingly, though, this is where it's interesting in my family, it was a very, I suppose you'd almost call it a Christian socialist family, a very thinking family. He had decided he was going to join up, but his brother, his older brother, Francis, was a pacifist and a confirmed socialist. So they sent him out to this farm, which was run by Quakers, I think, in Lincolnshire, and he helped feed the country by looking after the sheep and the pigs and that sort of thing. Anyway, he got married while he was there, and I think just a couple of years after he was married, no, a year after, his brother was killed. And he told me later on, he was babe in his arms, and I looked at my child, Nicola, she was called. And I thought, well, I can't let other people do the defending. You know, this is my child, I've got to. And he looked down at his baby and thought, there's no way I can stand aside now. So he joined up, and he joined something very special. So he became a secret agent in France for the last 3 years of the war, and had the most, I mean, you can't imagine, as a pacifist, he was as close to the enemy as you could possibly
be. Yeah.
And killing, as you would have to. So I had that in my family. That's why I told you this story. This story of what do you do about the world? Do you join in and defend, or do you... And I suppose I was on the side, really, at that stage, at the age of 16, 17 when I made up my mind. Yes, I joined the army, and also I have to say this, I knew you could go on playing rugby in the army, mm-hmm. and you could travel in the army. And I have to say, and I'm not saying this in any way it's vain anymore, but I look really good in a uniform. The upshot of it all was that after about a year in the army, I met Claire.
What, huh?
My stepfather was a highly intelligent literary man, a writer himself, Jack Morpurgo, but he was also history editor at Penguin Books. And Penguin Books had been started by a man called Alan Lane, mm-hmm. who was Claire's father.
Gosh.
And at a certain time, much later on, they were talking together, and Alan Lane said, "Well, my daughter's just off for a holiday in Greece. She's going backpacking." And Jack Morpurgo said, "Well, that's funny. We're going to Greece too. Perhaps we ought to meet up." And it was arranged that we should meet up on Corfu.
Oh, wonderful.
So she was with, I think, four friends backpacking around. I was with my family. She was staying in a bed and breakfast. And we sort of found where it was, and I remember it was dark. And we were standing, it was a building site with a great rubbish tip. I remember that. And we stood on the rubbish tip, and my stepfather said, "Oh, well, you better call out. I can call her. I said, "I don't know where you've met. I haven't met her." So they made me call out, and she appeared on a balcony. Can you imagine? And she happens to be rather beautiful then too, so she appeared. We had this rather strange conversation, and after which she went back inside, and having arranged to meet tomorrow, and we'd go for a swim. Anyway, so that's how we met. So it was all rather sudden. And it wasn't too long after that that she was asking me questions about why I was in the army, and I wasn't answering them very convincingly because I wasn't very convinced about it myself. I was having thoughts and doubts about whether this was the right way to spend my life. But then she got pregnant, which was absolutely her fault, nothing to do with me at all. ended up deciding I'd get married, much against...
Age?
I was 19.
Yes.
She was 21, I can't remember. Older, but, and that matters. She was 18 months older than me. And anyway, we got married, and it was much against the wishes of both sets of parents. So you can imagine our wedding in London. There were two sets of parents, but they didn't speak to each other much. And they weren't speaking to us much either. I mean, their parents were very nice and spoke to her, but I was definitely not flavour of the month. So it was a question of... What do we have? A Fuller's walnut cake and a bottle of champagne, and off you go. And I went to Reading. I was still at Sandhurst. I'd taken compassionate leave because I'd said my mother was ill. Ridiculous stuff. We're playing games. It's like a film script, really. Anyway, we got married in the registry office in Kensington. And I went back that very same day for a honeymoon. Having had failed my driving test... in Caversham, isn't it glorious, this? And we ended up at a place called the Complete Angler in Marlow.
I know.
You know it? Mm. One night there, and then she drove me back to Sandhurst. There we are. And I stayed for a little bit longer and left.
Well, you've stayed for a very long time in that marriage, then, and it's still going strong.
Rather longer than the army, yes.
So what happened after the army? And then you began life as a parent? And
I began life as a parent, and it was... I was trying to be a parent. You don't know anything at 19. It was ridiculous. I have no regrets at all about marrying and doing it at that age, but I didn't know anything. You don't.
Yeah.
You just think you know everything at that age. Anyway, I think what I wanted was a job. Basically, I needed a job. It was quite important. And so I got a job as a teacher in a prep school in Chichester. And... good thing was that I found that I liked it and I was really good at it. And then after that, we thought, well, yes, if you're going to go on this teaching, you need to go to university. So I ended up at King's College London. I got a really bad degree, ended it, and then went into teaching. And I stayed in teaching for about 8 years, teaching in private school and in the state school. I ended up in the state school system in Kent at a little school called Wickenbrew Primary School. And I was beginning already then to tell stories to the children.
Did you make them up, or you...
Well, I read them, first of all, the books that I remembered that my mother had read to me, bless her heart, so I liked that side of things, reading of stories. So I'd read those stories, but I ran out of ones I really liked, and I was reading one day. And anyway, it's probably the way I read it. Anyway, it wasn't working. So I went back and I told Claire, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I cannot go on with this story. They're just a little bit boring. It just, we mustn't bore children. She'd already been teaching herself, teacher training and things like that. I said, don't bore them. You know? Make up one yourself. It's her idea. She said, make up a story yourself. Anyway, I ended up going in there and by lying awake all night, really, first of all, making up a story. Went in there the next day and at 3 o'clock. I said, well, I'm not going on with the story of yesterday. And it was a typical year six response. They said, well, we liked it. I said, no, you didn't. Besides, anyway, I'd been up all night waking up a story. You know, you want to hear my story. So I told them the story.
And what was your story about?
Well, that was about local children, really. And anyway, I told them the story, and the first 5 minutes they just weren't interested. But then they got focused. And the more they got focused, the more encouraged I was, and the better I told it, I think, and the more I expanded it. And I got to 3:30, and the school bell went. The school bell went, and they all went, oh, sir, what happened? What happened? I said, I'll tell you tomorrow.
Oh, brilliant. So you had them.
I had them.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah. So well, it was the first time I discovered I knew I could do that. And Mrs. Skiffington, bless her heart, came in on the Friday because she'd heard about, they called me Mr. Morpinga. and they'd heard, she'd heard in the playground that people were talking about a story. So she came in, she sat at the back and folded her arms. I've never forgotten, looked at me rather sternly as I was telling the story. And I finished it. She came up to me and said, Michael, that was extraordinarily good, very good. I want you to write it out to me and give it to me on Monday morning.
Mm.
No one had ever told me that before. No one had spoken to me like that for years. I was being told by a teacher to do some homework. So I went home and I wrote it out. And she knew someone who worked in Macmillan, sent it off and got it published.
No.
Just like that.
And so that was the beginning.
That was the beginning. And then, of course, you get so encouraged by that, particularly encouraged. Didn't do well at all, but they did well enough for them to want another one, and then another one, and then another one. I'm a story maker, basically, not a writer at all. I think I make stories. That's what I really
think. Very interesting. Yeah.
I mean, to be honest with you, Dickens is a much better writer, but he was a maker of stories, you know. So that's what I am, really, a story maker, and I learnt it in front of a class of year six.
So what was your first hit?
I mean, the biggest hit was to get published. That's the first big hit. Any writer wants that, and so that book comes with a post that's got your name on it, and you feel, oh, that's okay. And that was the first sort of time I felt that there was something here I might be able to do. But the first book that ever got beyond that was one called Friend or Foe. And that, funnily enough, was set in the place we now live in Devon, because we were just changing from Kent, where I was living when I was teaching, to Devon, and going there. And
why did you move to Devon out of England?
Well, because, down to Claire, everything is down to Claire. When she was growing up, age 7, her daddy, this person I told you about, Alan Lane, took her to his favourite place on earth, which was the middle of Devon, the middle of nowhere, because he had a really good friend who ran the pub there, the Duke of York, in Iddesleigh, in the middle of Devon. And where do we now live?
Iddesleigh.
So he took her down there, and she loved it instantly. So much so that she insisted on going back on her own, age 7, to stay with the people around the pub who were good friends of Anna Lane's, Mr. and Mrs. Rafferty, Sean and Peggy Rafferty, who became like grandparents. And she would go back holiday after holiday after holiday for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, stay in the pub, if you please, on her own. And she only did one thing, and that was to put on her wellies every morning and go for a walk.
Now that's still happening, presumably.
That's still happening. And she felt this place was heaven, really. Yeah. It's her paradise. And which is why, to link the story later on, when we were thinking what do we do with our lives after teaching, she said, well, there's only one place to do that, and it's back in my childhood paradise, which is why we went back to Devon.
And you were earning money as a writer by this point?
Was earning money, but not much. You never do as a teacher, but enough to dig like. And also, to be honest, she had some income from her daddy. So we were never stretched financially, and I liked the work that I did, and I felt, 2 or 3 years in, I felt it was doing some good. But, there was a but, she realised from her experiences teaching, and I realised the same, roughly at the same moment, we were wondering what the point of it all was, because the people who came from homes where parents talked and they went off and did interesting things and went to the theatre, the teaching was fine, and it was all wonderful. But at least half a class anywhere, the children weren't like that. They were having these lives where very little happened. There was the television, and either parents were too exhausted to deal with the children, or one of them wasn't there, or whatever. There was always problems.
Yeah.
And for these sort of children, I didn't think school was doing them much good. So Claire and I both decided, her daddy died sadly in 1970, and Claire came into some money, and so we thought, well, let's put our money where, you know, our mouth is. Let's try and set up something which enriches the lives of the children who need it most. For the charity, she bought this great big house called Nethercote House, about a mile from the village of Iddesleigh. There's a farm with it, and we got to know the farmer next door. And we went to see the Inner London Education Authority and said, look, we set up this place. We want the kids to come for a week to live in the countryside and find out where their food comes from and to learn about feeling useful and how good that feels. And they said, fine idea, fine idea, but we haven't got any money. And I said, we don't want much. And I think it was £25 a week or something in those days. Luckily, the Inner London Education Authority did have at that time a grant system so that every single child, regardless of home income, was given £26 a week to go on a week away somewhere. So we started with London Kids. We had just had 9 schools. That's all we could get. 35 at a time, paying this very small amount. We had to equip the house. We had to employ people. We worked alongside a farmer, so the costs were always outreaching the amount of money we could get in. And we realised then we were going to have to raise money, make a charity, so that we could support the children who had very little to come. So next year after the start, we had 20 schools down, and the next year we had 33 schools down, and now all these years later we have 3 farms, one in Wales near St David's, another one in Gloucestershire, near Frampton on Severn, just outside Bristol. And so now with the 3 farms, we've had something in the region, well, over now 100,000 kids have come down. We're 50 years old now this next year, so we're going to have, we have a year of celebrations. So now I think we're in the business of trying to, I suppose, get people to know that this thing's been going on, of making available to everyone what's out there, what is there in this country. And for children, there is this massive resource out there, which is the countryside, which they hardly ever go to at all. Well, we didn't want it to be an ordinary place. We wanted it to be something which is beautiful in itself. So Nethercote is, no, it's not a lovely house. It looks like Hogwarts, but Hogwarts wasn't around then. It's a castellated Victorian place in Devon that sits looking from there. You can't see a house before Dartmoor, 10 miles away. And they have Dartmoor outside the window the whole time. Great big rooms and place to play, a place to study, dormitories.
What age are we talking about? Is there an age?
It's aged between 8 and 12, that sort of age range. Right, it's the last 2 years of primary school, first year of secondary. Yeah. It's not, we've had infants there. That's really funny. When they're small and they're spades, it's really funny. So we have, basically what we have is the schools that really want to make use of us properly.
Mm.
And the teachers make unbelievably strong relationships because they come down with them. And it becomes their place in the countryside too. It's like a heaven for them, like it was for Claire, saying. And she really wanted to create that kind of heaven or paradise for these children. And when you meet them all these years later, which we do all the time, by accident in the street, there will always be some great man. And I look up and he's 6'5". And he says to me, oh, hello, sir. I came to Nethercote when I was 8.
Oh.
And these are my children. You know, and that's what's really lovely. That this sort of, and they don't forget. It says, you made me muck out a calf bed, didn't you? I hated you. No, I didn't hate you. I remember the smell to this day. I didn't want to do it at all. And I said, but it needed doing, didn't he? He said, yeah, that was the point. He said, and then what we did is when we'd done the mucking out, which was the silliest thing I've ever done in my life, We had to get all the cars back in, but before we did that, we got to shake out the straw. That was the best. We got to shake out the straw. Mm-hmm. And then they came in and they would all dance around in the straw, and they all made us giggle. And then we played in the hay bales, and they just have such memories of it.
Yeah.
And that was the whole idea. And so I think her idea, Claire's idea, was that this should be for everyone. And that's the point of it. The kids who fail very often at school discover a whole other world and discover they can be useful. So one of our kids has grown up now, and she's had, I don't know, award-winning restaurant in New York and in London, and running them. You know, they find they can do stuff. And we got a letter from a kid the other day who is now not a kid anymore. She works in a cancer charity for research. She's got a PhD. But the letter said, what it told me my week down there was that anything is possible. Anything is possible. And that's what it is, and that's what we've got to teach our children.
Well, can we go on to that? Because I know overall you're optimistic from having read your book. But you're not particularly enamoured of the current way we're teaching our children in this country.
Well, we've got to get away from the idea, I think, really, that dividing our children into successes and failures, which is what happens. Because if you create a success in the way we do create success, which is through exams,
yes,
you can be sure there's a failure for everyone.
Yeah.
And what we haven't discovered is what to do about that. Well, the answer is that you don't have a system directed by something like Ofsted, which judges people on results.
Mm.
If you judge on the results, just like that, you will get a false notion of what the school has done for the child. To give you an idea, I mean, it's not just the one teacher who killed herself because
yes.
of what it
yes.
that. It's not just that. That was terrible. But in a sense, it tells you.
Can we just remind our listeners who might not be aware of that case?
Yeah. There was a wonderful teacher at primary school, and she was a wonderful head teacher. And her school failed and mm-hmm. Ofsted, or was downgraded or whatever. The system shames teachers.
Yeah.
If things aren't working, everyone is shamed.
Mm.
Well, we know with children, if you point a finger and stand them in the corner and make them feel small, that does not make them get on any better. What we all need in something as stressful as teaching is encouragement, reassurance. The parent-teacher relationship is difficult enough anyway now. Without someone from on high judging the head teacher and judging the teachers in front of the parents, well, why will the parents have any confidence with them at all? It's the wrong way to go about it. We do not want our children growing up feeling bad about themselves. I mean, that's terribly damaging, yes, to our mental health, but to our self-confidence, our self-worth. We've got to feel we're useful in this life. And you don't do it by pointing the finger at a school and saying, this place doesn't work. You put people in there who help make it work.
Mm.
That's how it should be. And maybe they've just done something today that instead of actually calling them good, bad, or whatever it was they were calling them, now it's going to be colour-coded.
Oh, no.
And you think to yourself, that is the degree of thinking that's going on. Let's make it a colour. So red is great and blue is terrible, or whatever it's going to be. Do you think people don't comprehend the same thing?
Mm-hmm.
We've got to feel, everyone's got to feel they're doing a decent job. The teachers have got to feel they're doing a decent job. If they're not, then they should be encouraged by people who know what they're doing to do a decent job. And they have to get parents on side. You know, that's something that's completely forgotten about. We talked about reading a moment ago.
Yeah.
I mean, the greatest asset a child has when you're very, very young is a parent who reads, who likes reading and wants you to like reading. It's critical. It's the pathway to knowledge and understanding. It's the surest and it's the cheapest.
So few children read anymore.
But the parents don't read anymore.
Yep.
I mean, it's not, you know, you can't point the finger at them. They are part of the modern culture, and the modern culture is the screen.
Yes.
To give you an idea, we all knew some time ago that 1 in 5 of our schools in this country does not have a library.
Yeah.
Imagine that. This is the country of Shakespeare, it's the country of Marlowe, it's the country of Philip Pullman, of J.K. Rowling.
And you.
Well, it doesn't. You cannot have a situation where there are any children not having availability to books. You know, we all go on, don't we, so much about, you know, we've got our health service, you know, it's free at the point of delivery. Well, so should literature be free at the point of delivery.
Yeah.
We're closing libraries like crazy. We've been doing that for years and years and years. And if a school doesn't library, that is the... That's the front line of bringing books to children. My mum used to read to myself and my brother Peter. She was an actor, okay, she could read very well, but she'd come and sit on our bed at night. She's a busy mum, like mums are, really busy. But she spent a quarter of an hour a day, 20 minutes, whatever it was, sitting on our bed and reading to the two of us. And then at the age of five, I walked along the road, past the sweet shop, to this place called St. Matthias. And they had books there too, but they didn't read them to make it interesting. They read it for testing, comprehension testing, spelling testing. Words became weapons to be judged by.
And really interesting.
Then you got stuck in the corner. I mean, now it's different. Then it was rulers and it was getting stuck in the corner. That was the kind of fear. Now it's failure. It's feeling stupid. I went off reading and stories completely by the age of 10, which is why I wanted to play rugby for England. It's all interest in me was playing rugby.
Yes, that's interesting that you yourself went off reading.
Well, completely. I'm not a great reader now. I read for my work. I read lots of books and poems and history and biographies and things like that. But I won't say it's because I have to, but I suppose in my head it's for a purpose.
Yeah.
I'm not. My wife, Claire, is a reader who just loves it. She just loves reading. And it has given us something wonderful in life. But if I'd had an uninterrupted mother, if you like, passing this on to me, I think I'd have been like that. I may not have been a writer at all, which may be a good thing, I don't know. But what the really interesting thing is, for me, is that we have to get away from the notion that what you do at school has to be judged.
Yeah.
What I learned, I told you what I learned from my school, was this confidence.
Yeah.
That's what I learned. And to give kids the confidence that they're worth something, that they can do something, is massive, absolutely massive. But you can't test that. The surveys tell us that children respect, have aspirations towards two things, money and celebrity.
Yes.
That's what matters.
Yes.
Well, we know that's not what matters in life. We know what matters in life is caring, yes, and sharing, all these things. Yes, it's getting on. Yes, it's fulfilling our aspirations. But it's not about money. It's certainly not about celebrity. And celebrity is fated like crazy all the time. We focus on that so, so much. And these children grow up thinking that's what's important. So the vast majority of them are not going to be celebrities. And they're not going to make money. So what are they going to feel about themselves if that is how we judge people? You might be thought of as nothing. Actually, you're something called a citizen. Rather important. And the kids have got to feel it's all right to be that, you know, part of society, not leading it, not dominating it. And
just going back to this very interesting what you're saying about people not having, you know, feeling bad about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thing you're most proud of in your life?
Well, now it's my... It is. I'm not being sentimental. It is my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. Proud is a funny old word. It means you're supposed to feel better about yourself because of it. I don't. It gives me the most pleasure.
Most pleasure.
I mean, I'll be honest about you. When a book comes out, it's in a small way quite like having another grandchild. Because it's new and it's different.
Yeah.
And I know the difference, but I do know the difference. The difference is that this grandchild is growing in front of my eyes and is becoming this human being and it's a good character. A book is a book is a book. It's not nearly as important. So I think it's the people, the friends that I've made and some that I've lost. Those are the things I take most pleasure from. Pride, I'm not sure of. I know I can feel it, but I tell you what happened the other evening. And I'm trying to find the word for it, really. The tour of Warhorse has just finished 18 months going around the country. And I went up in a way to say goodbye to the cast, up in Norwich, which is where they were. And Claire and I went up there, and they invited me onto the stage to say hello and goodbye to the staff, to the cast and the crew, everyone. And I stood there in front of what, 60, 70 people whose lives have been wrapped up in this thing, work their socks off for 18 months.
And touring with those giant puppets, not it's simple.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. The amount of work that goes into it. I get the reports every day, and you just see what they put into it. And I feel proud for them that they're out there each night. And I was there when there was yet another standing ovation afterwards. And it's the standing ovation is a sort of love for this thing and for the puppets and for the, but it's also the unbelievable energy they've put into it, and it makes me so thrilled that it was some little thing I started writing on a piece of paper all those years ago that was the beginning of all this, that it's grown like an acorn into this extraordinary oak tree of a show which goes on and on and on. It's going to be 20 years old quite soon.
And global, it goes around the world.
Absolutely. I think it's up, nearly 9 million people have seen it. I mean, it's utterly, utterly extraordinary. And it's not, what I love about it, it's not big and loud. I mean, the least successful thing about it, funnily enough, was the movie, which is interesting because it had the greatest name in movies attached to it. It was a good film, a lot of good things about it. But it was the theatre that got it going, that stopped it.
Again, just for the listeners, there's a very nice piece in your new book about how Warhorse came into being.
Yeah, but it was all luck. There's so much about the thing which is luck. It's being in that place, meeting those people, having that really strong connection, going back nearly 100 years to the horses that were brought from the farms onto the village green to be sold, and the young boys going off to the war at the beginning of it, and the memorial being there for... to real people, who people in the village living there now knew, their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers. It means something, you know. So you write about what you finally, you write about what you care about. Every writer does that. And I've just been really, really, really lucky. But proud is definitely not the right word. It's a deep, deep pleasure that this thing has caused... it's enriched so many people's lives, and certainly... by enriched, I don't mean lots of money. And what I love about it, it's the fate playing kindly, with me, but with the project. And I feel it's lovely. I'm tickled pink because GWR, the railway that takes us...
Great Western Railways, yes.
decided to name a train after the horse.
Oh.
So we went along...
Oh, wonderful.
..to a ceremony at Paddington Station... where they had drawn the horse, but it's the National Theatre horse, in other words, the one that looks like a puppet, with Joey, the name, under it. My name is at the other end of the train. And we had a ceremony, and the National Theatre sent along Joey. So Joey got himself together, as you have to, in the first-class lounge, and was trotted through all these thousands of people in the concourse to platform 8, where the train was due to go from, where we had a little ceremony. It was just so extraordinarily moving. These little kids, what happened? Is this coming towards us? And there was no television cameras, nothing to make it a big deal. It was just this walking through the crowds. And it happened to be quite close. And what I really loved about it is that by accident, whose statue was there right outside the first class lounge? Paddington.
Oh.
So there was this wonderful nose-to-nose picture of Paddington and Joey, these two representations of children's books. And it was just a moment, a real moment, and there were enough people there who recognised that. And it's a thrill, but it's not a pride, it's a great thrill. And then if I get on that train, I shall certainly go and give him a pat, that's for sure.
What a wonderful place to end. Michael Morpurgo, who's not proud but tickled pink.
Tickled pink is the word, yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on Radio Oldie. You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Michael Morpurgo. If you'd like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my very warm thanks again to you, Michael Morpurgo, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.